when I wake up. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Moore Show.
I say a little
prayer
for you.
And while combing my hair now, and wondering
and now, your host, Gary Moore.
I say a little
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn from Tohoku University in Japan about how large long-term studies show that eating mushrooms will lower your risk of prostate cancer. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal International Journal of Cancer. We have about 15 original studies to share with you today. You're not going to read about them or hear about them in the mainstream media. But we scan every single day the world literature to bring you information that can allow you to live a longer and healthier life. Also today, I'll be doing a commentary, an original commentary on a topic that is important. It's for everyone, though it's addressed specifically to the young climate activists. The article is entitled Advice from Veteran Voices of Protest to Young Climate Activists. Richard Gale and myself have written this over the last couple of days, but everyone can benefit from it. Positive things we can do instead of waiting through the inertia and hubris and conflicts of interest and denialism of corporate America and also governments around the world who are not going to do anything. So we're going to do that. Then I have some really neat audio clips to share with you today. And one of those audio clips is about a different way of understanding teaching and learning. It's very positive, very upbeat. I think you'll really appreciate it. The other clip is about a professor in the technological science from Oxford University talking about, do we really have an addiction to the internet? Some will say yes, some will say no. He gives one of the most plausible explanations about being on the internet and what it will or won't do to us, and should we really equate that in the same way we would talk about a drug addict or an alcoholic? It's a very interesting insight. Those are just some of the clips that we're going to talk about today, and it depends upon how much time we have if I'll do a third. Again, the third one is a medical doctor. She comes from China. She talks about her mother and being raised by a Chinese traditional family. But it's an extraordinarily honest piece. I really appreciate what this woman has done. She's brave. She represents a potential paradigm change in explaining to patients what they should know about the doctor and how the doctor can explain their own insights, biases, where they make their money. This is radical, but in a good way. And of course, they tried to destroy her. Not surprising there. So if time permits, I'll play that and I'll ask for your feedback on these issues. But we always begin our program every day by going to the things that can make a difference. And I just want to share this one thought. Our sister station BAI, where I've been for 45 years, the longest running uninterrupted daily radio program in American history, non-commercial program, and they're going through some rough times. Yesterday morning, people entered the building, locked all the doors, locked out the staff, and then fired everyone and put in canned music. This is the National Foundation. Just a thought real quick. I've been saying that this was going to happen for some time. There was a possibility of three different scenarios. Close down the station, pipe in the information, and then tell them you're doing it for the good of this foundation, as if BAI is a massively infected gangrene leg, and it's turning septic, and you must cut off the leg to save the body. And that will be a very easy sell. You talk all about how they're behind $4 million and what they owe the foundation, $2 to $4 million, and how they can't pay their payroll on time, how they can't pay their rent. They're behind on all bills. They haven't sent out their premiums. They're not raising money. They have a dwindling audience. All of which is true. But it's not the full story. The full story is all five Pacifica stations are in debt, can't make bills, are deep, deep in denial, and run by massive incompetence, in my opinion. They refuse, because of ideology, to hire real professionals, people who have a deep background in non-professional radio, non-profit radio, who've run foundations, and hire people who are good at hiring the best people out there to do shows that are relevant and needed by the public, and build and sustain an audience, by the way, which thousands of nonprofit stations in America do, with even much smaller signals. No rancor, no internecine conflicts. Run nicely. No hassles, no drama, no crisis. But Pacifica prides itself on how much crisis and drama it can create, and self-interest. And the idea is, people ultimately want to sell that license, sell it or exchange it. Exchange meaning you exchange a license, you get, let's say, for argument's sake, $10 to $15 million. Now you go from a 50,000 watt in the middle of the dial, way down the dial, to a 5,000 watt. But you've got $15 million. That can help a lot of the other stations, and it keeps BAI alive. I don't believe that's their intent. Or you turn it over to someone locally who is associated with Pacifica and who's going to run it the right way. Of course, they'll purge all of the programming they don't like and put in programming that meets their ideology, and for all intents and purposes, BAI is gone. Or they simply out and out say, we got to sell the station and give that money to the other stations. What they do with that money, no one knows, because only the people in control know what their intent is. In any case, we're sorry to see that BAI was dealt the way a judge overnight in New York State put a restraining order in, and in 10 days there will be a court hearing on this. This is in the middle of a fund drive. This is when premiums have not been sent out. You lock down a station, you fire everyone, who's supposed to send out the premiums? No one there. Were you supposed to send the premiums? There's no place to send them. Remember, at the end of the day, all lawsuits, all bills, all payroll, all expenses are the responsibility of the corporate headquarters, the foundation which controls the licenses. And boy, have people not thought through this action smartly. So we will see what happens. I reached out to all the producers that we could reach. I reached out to all the management and told them my staff was at their disposal, that we were making emergency arrangements to keep programs on the air through our own network, and even rehabilitating a studio that we are no longer in. We've moved, but we still control it. We own it. And no one made a call, not a single call or email from anyone. So unfortunately, but this is part of what you expect at BAI. But we're still there to help if they ever turn around and ask for it. Now to our program. And this is the latest again on health issues. This is about the results from the first long-term cohort study of 36,000 Japanese men over decades. And they found that those who ate the most mushrooms had the lowest risk of prostate cancer. Now, let's go a little deeper in this. Prostate cancer begins when cells in the prostate gland, a small walnut-shaped gland found only in men, which produces the fluid that forms part of the semen. And the start to the growing out of control occurs there. It is one of the most common forms of cancer affecting men. About 1,200,000 new cases are diagnosed worldwide, and it gets more widely spread as you get older. Now, mushrooms are widely used in Asia, far more in the United States, and they use them for their nutritional and medicinal properties. And there's a strong relationship between using mushrooms in dishes and soups and salads, sautés, and being healthy. By the way, it's great for anti-cancer overall. Lots of studies on that. So they took a look at men, and this is what they found. So the takeaway message is this. Don't eat raw mushrooms. You're not getting the release of their benefit. sautéed mushrooms, yes. Shiitake, maitake, button mushrooms, white mushrooms, all good for you. From Patel University School of Medicine in India comes a study about ashwagandha. Ash, A-S-H, waganda, W-A-G-A-N-D-H-A, improves your sleep. And that's important because we are a world of insomniacs, and they received ashwagandha root extract or a placebo twice daily for 10 weeks. And then sleep activity was measured, and they found that those who took the ashwagandha got a much better and deeper and fuller night's sleep. Good information. Ashwagandha is great for diabetes and other issues as well. From the University of Burgundy, which is in France, published in the Canadian Journal of Cardiology, about regular exercise is good for your heart, no matter how old you are. So remember, the older you get, the more you need exercise. Just the opposite of what we were taught. I can remember as a kid running around because I had all this energy. I was wiry. I couldn't afford a bike until I got a paper route, and then it took me 2 years to buy a Raleigh, and then another 3 years before I could buy a Schwinn. And cutting grass in the summertime, and we'd be out there, and the people who knew what they were doing always had mowers that moved real smooth. The blades were always sharp, and we would cut the neighbor's grass for 10 cents. It was a real big lawn, and then it was a quarter. And in time, you saved. Saved up the quarters in the quarter jar, the nickels in the nickel jar, the dimes and dimes. I'm sure other people remember doing it, something similar. And it was worth it. It taught us the merits of intent and responsibility. Be responsible. That's one of the things I really support Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, Sea Scouts, Eagle Scouts, because it teaches responsibility. But once you graduate from college or high school, and don't go to college, you were not expected to be athletic. You were not expected to exercise. You weren't expected just to let yourself go. But the assumption was that the death process was inevitable, and generally within the first 60 years, and if you live more than 60 years, you were considered living a long life and a good life, and rarely do people live beyond the 70s. Once in a great while, you would find someone who lived in their 80s, even their 90s, and nobody ever knew exactly why. And I asked once my father, why aren't you out there exercising? He says, for what reason? I said, to keep in shape. He said, I'm in shape. I said, Dad, you're not in shape. You know, you've gotten heavier over the last 5 years. Well, that's normal, he said. I said, it's not normal. It is average. It's not normal. No matter what I did, my arguments never made a difference. And I'm very honest with myself that, you know, I was never able to help a single member of my family. I did help my brother when, you know, I helped my father when the surgeon who was his friend from growing up said that we got to, you know, sew your dad back up and let him bleed out. I said, what do you mean bleed out? No, you're not going to lie. Well, we can't stop the bleeding. He won't clot. You know, and we took a whole gallon bucket of stomach cancer out. But you're the one who said that he had no cancer. He was just having indigestion. Well, mistakes are made. Do you pay for your mistakes? Or do you profit from them? He didn't like that conversation, but I got my dad immediately up to New York City, brought him in my apartment in a wheelchair. He looked about 90 years old. He was 57. And started him on a strict regimen. And within 24 hours, the blood clotted. And within 3 months, he was up and walking 3 miles, gained back about 20 pounds and that he needed. And I never will forget the conversation when I came back from BAI, the studio, and he had his suitcase back. I said, what's going on? He said, well, I got to go back to Parkersburg. I said, why? Another month and you'll be cancer-free. The cancer is 85% gone. He said, I know, but the doctor wants to know what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, and I can, you know, I can help him, and hence he can help other people. I said, Dad, this is a closed-minded doctor who's going to let you bleed out like they would let an animal bleed out in a slaughterhouse. No, don't go. And all evening and all night until he left, he wouldn't change his mind. He was very stubborn, unfortunately. And, of course, he went back, and they didn't pay attention to him, and months went by, and then back came the cancer. So that's the world I know. That's the real world. It's not to be angry about it. It's to be mindful of it. We're not all open-minded. We're not all going to change if there's a better way. But boy, when people have the control over your life and say that what they know is the only thing to know, and what they do is the only thing that should be done, and you trust them, and then every year, over 1 million Americans per year are buried who did nothing except 100% of what authority figures told them to do. So let's say over the last 40 years, 40 million Americans have died. Can you name me a greater genocide in world history? That's more than the Second World War total, including Russians. That's more than Mao's stupid and completely insane programs for the ruralization of Africa, of China, and all the other policies. It's, no, right here, doctors who have the best of intentions but have the worst protocols and are not willing to change them, and they're rewarded for that. Is there any irony in this? In any case, the irony was that nobody was allowed or encouraged to exercise. In fact, you would have stood out. So they didn't exercise, and they didn't stop smoking, and they didn't stop drinking, and they didn't stop eating a bad diet. So exactly what was supposed to be the outcome? Well, we see it. So thank goodness now, at least, it is completely acceptable for people of all ages to exercise, and I would like for the advertisers to stop engaging in merciless ageism by portraying everyone over the age of 60 as somehow suffering from defects, deformities, or deficiencies to which they need that particular medication. Because I can show you some very healthy senior citizens who biologically are much younger than their chronological age. In fact, we're proving that, or attempting to prove that right now scientifically. But here's the takeaway message. Regular exercise is really good for your heart. And since we have a high level of heart attacks and strokes and heart failure and clogged arteries, you need to exercise, no matter what any of the people who don't want to exercise tell you. Also, I've mentioned many times in this program, curcumin. C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N. This is from Sir Takahashi General Hospital in India, and they just found another reason to take curcumin. Curcumin boosts brain health and relaxes you from being anxious, so it's great as an anti-anxiety. Now, there are hundreds of studies that it's antiviral, it's antifungal, it's anti-cancer, so now you can also add it's anti-anxiety. And the use of turmeric for medicinal purposes is not new. In fact, it's the mainstay in both Chinese and Indian cultures for a long time. The Indian subcontinent, turmeric, was the ingredient from which curcumin was derived. They used to treat wounds because of its anti-inflammatory properties, keep wounds from going toxic or septic. It's a strong antioxidant. And it's just terrific. But now, according to the peer-reviewed journal of phytotherapy research, they found that curcumin is just as effective as an antidepressant, fluoxetine, which is Prozac, to relieve symptoms of depression or even low mood and anxiety. So now you have a natural, non-toxic substance that can help you more than a worthless, toxic drug. And you can read also in Clinical Neuropharmacology, the use of curcumin as an antidepressant, another study. And when paired with an antidepressant, for those who say, well, I must have my antidepressant, they were more effective. And finally, from Federal University of Sergipe in Brazil, comes lemongrass, lemon, L-E-M-O-N, grass, G-R-A-S-S, one word. It also provides anxiety relief. And that's good. Lemongrass is great. I love lemongrass. I grow lemongrass. You know, when it's full of all the nutrients and that unique lemon quality, and it's an aromatic, it's great for stomach problems, joint pain, the common cold, fever, and as a body toxicant, a detoxification, I should say, of toxins. You can make it as an iced tea, which I do in hot weather, and I like to make lemongrass and then put one drop of mint in there, and the mint and the lemongrass together just make this wonderful cacophony of delicious taste in your mouth, and it's thirst-quenching. Lemongrass essential oil is a natural detoxification agent. So, but it also helps with anxiety. Just saying, a lot of things we can do that we haven't in the past. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 21 minutes into the program. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. Oh, and by the way, for the skeptics out there who listen every day and hope that, you know, there's some big gap made. Well, friends, I know you don't believe in the mind and body and meditation. It's all so stupid and nonsensical quackery. And only, quote, lunatic charlatans, according to Jimmy Wells, would trust any of this. Hey, American Heart Association today released a statement recommending meditation as a way to potentially reduce the risk of heart disease. Wow. This was a, quote, meditation and cardiovascular risk reduction, a scientific statement from the American Heart Association. Quote, a potential attractive, cost-effective adjuvant to more traditional medical therapy. So, now the American Medical Association is kind of at odds with you. Do you think in all your future statements on Wikipedia you should say, do not trust the American Heart Association or any of its members, any of the cardiologists who practice anything that they're suggesting, because they're saying things like meditation. My God, our heads are going to explode. They must be charlatans, right? Wikipedia, skeptics, you're on the wrong side of everything. And today, the entire board of directors for the Wikipedia or Wikimedia Foundation that controls Wikipedia got a letter. I don't think anyone's going to like the letter. It's from a group of attorneys. But you might want to ask them, what's next? You'll see, coming at you real soon. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. One more reason to write down these numbers, because just like all the people woke up yesterday and tuned in at noon, and I was not on BAI nor anyone else, then how many of those people thought, you know, he gave us those numbers so many times, I should have paid attention. How about paying attention now? Let's write them down. This is to listen live each day. 605-562-7900. 605-562-7900. But let's say you miss live, you want to listen on the archives. Fine. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Now to a commentary. This is posted. Please share it with others. It's entitled Advice from Veteran Voices of Protest to Young Climate Activists. Finally, there are noticeable stirrings of a world awakening to the plight of civilization in a livable planet. After 50 years of false starts, a diverse community of independent voices are finally being heard en masse, such as Chris Hedges, Jane Goodall, Bill McKibben, Guy McPherson, Vandana Shiva, and more recently, the 16-year-old Greta Thunberg, Jamie Magdalene, and other environmental youth leaders. This is a good thing. We are being warned that our Western lifestyle, as individual consumers trapped in the fangs of neoliberal capitalist mythologies of infinite progress and development, are having an astronomically detrimental impact upon our Earth's finite resources and ecological diversity. Ultimately, as the MIT's Limits of Growth report warned 47 years ago, continuing business as usual will have dire consequences. Unfortunately, there is no concerted collective international effort to deal with humanity's rate of consumption and addiction to economic growth. During the past year, the climate and environmental news has been consistently reporting record heat waves and the hottest months on record since temperature measurements were started. Reactionary governments in the United States, Brazil, India, and Indonesia are further destroying the last protected reserves of our natural ecologies. Overpopulated cities are being threatened by water shortages and rising sea levels. And climate scientists repeatedly warn that tipping points are nearer than previously calculated. But since we have specialized in examining on a daily basis tipping points for the last 10 years, we can tell you of the 42 known tipping points, half have already tipped. That does not mean we should not try to stop others from tipping. What has fundamentally shifted is that it is no longer a fringe group of climatologists and boisterous environmental activists who comprehend the atmospheric science's extreme predictions. For too long, these have been the lone voices sounding the alarm for immediate global action by governments and private industry before it is too late. Instead, it was left to a 16-year-old girl, Greta Thunberg, to force the international politic to begin paying attention.
We're talking now about the advice that all of us who have been a part of any movement, especially the environmental movement, can share with younger people, but all of us should debate at the feet of a group of young teenagers. They have neither the experience of life, nor do they have the experience of the environmental sciences to know everything that should be done. So I'm going to share some very positive suggestions for everyone. And so today, what we have is we have a younger generation who are then being motivated by hopefully the millennials and post-millennials or the iGen lingering in a virtual comfort zone and more awakening to climate change's imminent threats is needed now for all these individuals. Yet consciousness about details is lacking. So what we're doing, we're providing a series of articles and documentaries and books so that people can become very educated quickly about here's the problem, here are solutions. Even with Greta's message and the renowned popular directive of urgency, we believe that very little will likely change the United States, China, India, and many other developed countries. And these are the countries that can say, we don't care how many people march, you still have to eat. And you want to know something, Gary and Richard? The very kids, young kids, teenagers, millennials who are marching, these individuals will leave the march and go have a hamburger.
And that hamburger is going to come from beef where soybeans were grown in Brazil and then shipped off to China or the United States. So you have not captured the true and authentic spirit of a revolutionary movement. You've only distracted them. It's not going to hurt our bottom line. We're going to continue to develop the rainforests of the world. We're going to continue to exploit. And in one way, they are correct. Corporate executives and politicians care little about school-striking teenagers on the march. They're not stockholders, and they're not voters. In the United States, the roughly 16 million Americans representing the highly educated and professional class and the elite, 0.01%, and their families, are motivated solely by the drive to increase their standard of living and socioeconomic influence. They dictate the public discourse in the mainstream media and are fully aware of the problems humanity faces. By intention, they also choose to retreat from the solutions. Democrats, libertarians, and Republicans alike are neoliberal ideologues. The Green New Deal will likely be ruled unattainable because it's nonsensical in the fundamentals. Much of its agenda is embarrassingly immature because it throws its weight behind a perverse green neoliberal corporatist capitalist economy in order to generate a green market to keep the wealthy flush in green paper. Yet it is the same leaders of industry and their political enablers who need to come up with the radical solutions. And they're not going to come up with the radical solutions if it means losing power, losing control, or losing money in the process. Therefore, we are suggesting that Greta and other activists align with her message, be very pragmatic. When she spoke before an assembly of the global cream de la cream at Davos, these were the same people who flew into Switzerland on private jets and dined on Kobe steaks. This corporate elite are the greenest contributors and supporters of global warming and environmental degradation. Al Gore and his ilk of hedge funders, the large environmental organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, the Natural Resource Defense Council, and the World Business Council for Sustainable Development are already eager to take advantage of Greta's international attention naivety. Was she aware of this? I doubt it. We continue to support, and should all adults support, the Teenage Friday School strikes and protests, because from that, maybe 5% of them will become activists. But there is much that students can do on the campuses of their high school and colleges to further coordinate events and utilize resources to better educate themselves about the future they will be forced to navigate. There are also many veteran activists among boomers who have deep experience in strategic protests during the Vietnam War and the early civil rights movement. They're still alive. They could be contributing. So seeking guidance and advice from seasoned dissidents can only benefit the climate youth movement despite its understandable and valid reluctance. There is much to be gained by creating campus teach-ins focused upon the following: the ecological health and benefits of adopting a plant-based diet and going vegetarian or vegan, learning from community organizers about the social assets from buying local, creating urban and community organic farms, conscious recycling, etc. The need for a new slow movement, what we will call a minimalist movement in our lifestyle to counter the destructive habits of our runaway consumer obsolescence culture. Workshops in many individual ways that we can reduce our energy consumption and pressure schools to do the same. Every school in America could be mandated, and college and university, go organic, go vegan, and go green. Listening to the wisdom of Native American and other indigenous voices about humanity's connection with nature and our responsibility to protect it. What if every single school in America had by requirement to have one class in Native American culture and their understanding of life, nature, and that respected balance? Educating themselves about the enormous health and environmental risks from the new 5G technology, getting all Wi-Fi out of schools, or getting the Internet of Everything, starting to disconnect from the Internet, at least initially, to 1 hour a day. That is being, by the way, 5G falsely advertised as a green solution to reduce energy consumption. It is not. Nuclear is being said to be a good green movement by Cortez and others. It is not. Organizing collective efforts to protect local ecologies and plants and planting trees is a responsible thing. So in conclusion, all the responsibility should not rest upon our youth to mobilize our nations. A growing compassion is critical and urgent among adults, getting out of our comfort zone. When you ask the 20 million Americans now living comfortably, and they earn their livelihood, I do not criticize them for their living in gated communities, but when was the last time you did anything for the world or the community? Their first response is always going to be defensive. But I worked hard and I deserve my time now, and it's my time and I'm going to do what I want and someone else to take over. What exactly did you do to help the environment when you were working? What do you want to bet? Nothing. So it's time that we got past our own defense mechanisms and realize it's our planet. Nor does the Earth care whether or not humans breed on her skin like parasites. Faced with the Earth's apathy, Ralph Waldo Emerson's words become all too poignant. The end of the human race will be that it will eventually die of civilization. I'm Gary Nall. Just another comment to help us all become more conscious of the world we live on, more respectful, more thoughtful, and begin to engage individually, no matter what our conditioned self says. We're going to complete our show today by going to this doctor. Now, this doctor is really interesting, and her name is Liana, L-E-A-N-A, Wen, W-E-N. She comes from a traditional Chinese background in education, and it's not the first part of her story that's the most interesting. It's what she sees as important later, and I absolutely support what she is doing. And I'll do more on this and discuss this at greater length, hopefully have her on as a guest in the upcoming programs. Now to this is a talk about 15 minutes long from Dr. Wen.
Peter. To my own profession, that I should be fired, had my medical license taken away, that I should go back to my own country. My email got hacked. In a discussion forum for other doctors, someone took credit for Twitter bombing my account. Now, I didn't know if this was a good or bad thing, but then came the response, too bad it wasn't a real bomb. I never thought that I would do something that would provoke this level of anger among other doctors. Becoming a doctor was my dream. I grew up in China, and my earliest memories are of being rushed to the hospital because I had such bad asthma that I was there nearly every week. I had this one doctor, Dr. Sam, who always took care of me. She was about the same age as my mother. She had this wild, curly hair, and she always wore these bright yellow flowery dresses. She was one of those doctors whom, if you fell and you broke your arm, she'd ask you why you weren't laughing, because it's your humerus, get it? See, you've grown, but she'd always make you feel better after having seen her. Well, we all have that childhood hero that we want to grow up to be just like, right? Well, I wanted to be just like Dr. Sam. When I was 8, my parents and I moved to the U.S., and ours became the typical immigrant narrative. My parents cleaned hotel rooms and washed dishes and pumped gas so that I could pursue my dream. Well, eventually, I learned enough English, and my parents were so happy the day that I got into medical school and took my oath of healing and service. But then one day, everything changed. My mother called me to tell me that she wasn't feeling well, that she had this cough that wouldn't go away, that she was short of breath and tired. Well, I knew that my mother was someone who never complained about anything. For her to tell me that something was the matter, I knew something had to be really wrong. And it was. We found out that she had stage 4 breast cancer, cancer that by then had spread to her lungs, her bones, and her brain. My mother was brave, though, and she had hope. She went through surgery and radiation and was on her third round of chemotherapy when she lost her address book. She tried to look up her oncologist's phone number on the internet, and she found it, but she found something else too. on several websites, he was listed as a highly paid speaker to a drug company, and in fact, often spoke on behalf of the same chemo regimen that he had prescribed her. She called me in a panic, and I didn't know what to believe. Maybe this was the right chemo regimen for her, but maybe it wasn't. It made her scared, and it made her doubt. When it comes to medicine, having that trust is a must. And when that trust is gone, then all that's left is fear. There's another side to this fear. As a medical student, I was taking care of this 19-year-old who was biking back to his dorm when he got struck and hit, run over by an SUV. He had 7 broken ribs, shattered hip bones, and he was bleeding inside his belly and inside his brain. Now imagine being his parents who flew in from Seattle 2,000 miles away to find their son in a coma. I mean, you'd want to find out what's going on with him, right? They asked to attend our bedside rounds where we discussed his condition and his plan, which I thought was a pretty reasonable request and also would give us a chance to show them how much we were trying and how much we cared. The head doctor, though, said no. He gave all kinds of reasons. Maybe they'll get in the nurse's way. Maybe they'll stop students from asking questions. He even said, "What if they see mistakes and sue us?" What I saw behind every excuse was deep fear. And what I learned was that to become a doctor, we have to put on our white coats, put up a wall, and hide behind it. There's a hidden epidemic in medicine. Of course, patients are scared when they come to the doctor, right? I mean, imagine you wake up with this terrible belly ache. You go to the hospital, you're lying in this strange place, you're on this hospital gurney, you're wearing this flimsy gown, strangers are coming to poke and prod at you. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't even know if you're going to get that blanket that you asked for 30 minutes ago. But it's not just patients who are scared. Doctors are scared too. We're scared of patients finding out who we are and what medicine is all about. And so what do? We put on our white coats and we hide behind them. Of course, the more we hide, the more people want to know what it is that we're hiding. The more fear then spirals into mistrust and poor medical care. We don't just have a fear of sickness, we have a sickness of fear. Can we bridge this disconnect between what patients need and what doctors do? Can we overcome the sickness of fear? Well, let me ask you differently, if hiding isn't the answer, what if we did the opposite? What if doctors were to become totally transparent with our patients? Last fall, I conducted a research study to find out what it is that people want to know about their healthcare. I didn't just want to study patients in a hospital, but everyday people. So my two medical students, Suhavi Tucker and Laura Johns, literally took their research to the streets. They went to banks, coffee shops, senior centers, Chinese restaurants, and train stations. What do they find? Well, when we ask people, what do you want to know about your healthcare? People responded with what they want to know about their doctors, because people understand healthcare to be the individual interaction between them and their doctors. When we ask people, what do you want to know about your doctors? People gave 3 different answers. Some want to know that their doctor is competent and certified to practice medicine. Some want to be sure that their doctor is unbiased and is making decisions based on evidence and science, not on who pays them. Surprisingly to us, many people want to know something else about their doctors. Jonathan, a 28-year-old law student, says he wants to find someone who is comfortable with LGBTQ patients and specializes in LGBT health. Serena, a 32-year-old accountant, says that it's important to her for her doctor to share her values when it comes to reproductive choice and women's rights. Frank, a 59-year-old hardware store owner, doesn't even like going to the doctor and wants to find someone who believes in prevention first and who is comfortable with alternative treatments. One after another, our respondents told us that that doctor-patient relationship is a deeply intimate one, that to show their doctors their bodies and tell them their deepest secrets, they want to first understand their doctor's values. Just because doctors have to see every patient doesn't mean that patients have to see every doctor. People want to know about their doctors first so that they can make the informed choice. As a result of this, I formed a campaign, Who's My Doctor?, that calls for total transparency in medicine. Participating doctors voluntarily disclose on a public website not just information about where we went to medical school and what specialty we're in, but also our conflicts of interest. we go beyond the government Sunshine Act about drug company affiliations, and we talk about how we're paid. Incentives matter. If you go to your doctor because of back pain, you might want to know that he's getting paid $5,000 to perform spine surgery versus $25 to refer you to see a physical therapist, or if he's getting paid the same thing, no matter what he recommends. Then we go one step further. We add our values when it comes to women's health, LGBT health, alternative medicine, preventive health, and end-of-life decisions. We pledge to our patients that we are here to serve you, so you have a right to know who we are. We believe that transparency can be the cure for fear. Well, I thought some doctors would sign on and others wouldn't, but I had no idea of the huge backlash that would ensue. Within 1 week of starting Who's My Doctor, Medscape's public forum and several online doctors' communities had thousands of posts about this topic. Here are a few. From a gastroenterologist in Portland, "I devoted 12 years of my life to being a slave. I have loans and mortgages. I depend on lunches from drug companies to serve patients." Well, times may be hard for everyone, but try telling your patient making $35,000 a year to serve a family of four that you need the free lunch. From an orthopedic surgeon in Charlotte, "I find it an invasion of my privacy to disclose where my income comes from. My patients don't disclose their incomes to me." But your patient's sources of income don't affect your health. From a psychiatrist in New York City, "Pretty soon we will have to disclose whether we prefer cats to dogs, what model of car we drive, and what toilet paper we use." Well, how you feel about Toyotas or Cottonelle won't affect your patient's health, but your views on women's right to choose and preventive medicine and end-of-life decisions just might. And my favorite, from a Kansas City cardiologist, "More government-mandated stuff? Dr. Nguyen needs to move back to her own country." Well, two pieces of good news. First of all, this is meant to be voluntary and not mandatory. And second of all, I'm American, and I'm already here. Within a month, my employers were getting calls asking for me to be fired. I received mail at my undisclosed home address with threats to contact the medical board to sanction me. My friends and family urged me to quit this campaign. After the bomb threat, I was done. But then I heard from patients. Over social media, a tweet chat, which I learned what that was by then, generated 4.3 million impressions, and thousands of people wrote to encourage me to continue. They wrote with things like, "If doctors are doing something they're that ashamed of, they shouldn't be doing it. Elected officials have to disclose campaign contributions. Lawyers have to disclose conflicts of interest. Why shouldn't doctors?" And finally, many people wrote and said, "Let us patients decide what's important when we're choosing a doctor." In our initial trial, over 300 doctors have taken the Total Transparency Pledge. What a crazy new idea, right? But actually, this is not that new of a concept at all. Remember Dr. Sam, my doctor in China with the goofy jokes and the wild hair? Well, she was my doctor, but she was also our neighbor who lived in the building across the street. I went to the same school as her daughter. My parents and I trusted her because we knew who she was and what she stood for, and she had no need to hide from us. Just one generation ago, this was the norm in the U.S. as well. You knew that your family doctor was the father of two teenage boys, that he quit smoking a few years ago, that he says he's a regular churchgoer, but you see him twice a year, once on Easter, and once when his mother-in-law comes to town. You knew what he was about, and he had no need to hide from you. But the sickness of fear has taken over, and patients suffer the consequences. I know this firsthand. My mother fought her cancer for 8 years. She was a planner, and she thought a lot about how she wanted to live and how she wanted to die. Not only did she sign advance directives, she wrote a 12-page document about how she had suffered enough, how it was time for her to go. One day when I was a resident physician, I got a call to say that she was in the intensive care unit. By the time I got there, she was about to be intubated and put on a breathing machine. "But this is not what she wants," I said, "and we have documents." The ICU doctor looked at me in the eye, pointed at my then 16-year-old sister and said, "Do you remember when you were that age? How would you have liked to grow up without your mother?" Her oncologist was there too and said, "This is your mother. Can you really face yourself for the rest of your life if you don't do everything for her?" I knew my mother so well. I understood what her directives meant so well. And I was a physician. That was the single hardest decision I ever made, to let her die in peace. And I carry those words of those doctors with me every single day. We can bridge the disconnect between what doctors do and what patients need. We can get there because we've been there before, and we know that transparency gets us to that trust. Research has shown us that openness also helps doctors, that having open medical records, being willing to talk about medical errors, will increase patient trust, improve health outcomes, and reduce malpractice. That openness, that trust, is only going to be more important as we move from the infectious to the behavioral model of disease. Bacteria may not care so much about trust and intimacy, but for people to tackle the hard lifestyle choices to address issues like smoking cessation, blood pressure management, and diabetes control, what that requires us to establish trust. Here's what other transparent doctors have said. Brandon Combs, an internist in Denver, "This has brought me closer to my patients. The type of relationship I've developed, that's why I entered medicine." Final thought. Being totally transparent is scary. You feel naked, exposed, and vulnerable. But that vulnerability, that humility, it can be an extraordinary benefit to the practice of medicine. When doctors are willing to step off our pedestals, take off our white coats, and show our patients who we are and what medicine is all about, that's when we begin to overcome the sickness of fear. That's when we establish trust. That's when we change the paradigm of medicine from one of secrecy and hiding to one that is fully open and engaged for our patients.
Okay, there you have it. Very important insight. I'll go into this in greater depth because she's open to alternative therapy. She's open to natural approaches. She's open to prevention. And to working with patients and being completely transparent and open and honest. Good for her. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow and tonight at the Progressive Commentary Hour at 7 o'clock. Have a nice day, everyone.